Welcome to the IMD Podcast Network. Today, an interview with Richard Baldwin, Professor of International Economics. Richard is a leading authority on global economic policy and international trade, recognized for his insights into the economic drivers and risks of globalization. We're talking today about Donald Trump. The first few months of his presidency for the next 3.5 years, it's been a wild ride. I mean, month to month, there has been more news than anyone could reasonably take in, but that's what we're going to try and do today. But I expect Richard will try and narrow it down a little. First, I'd like to say welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've already said we're going to be talking about Donald Trump, the man who has attracted possibly the most amount of media coverage and speculation and analysis of any man, perhaps in the history of the world so far. We could maybe contend that. We could talk about the Genghis Khans, the Hitlers. I don't want to just mention them. Maybe the Winston Churchills too. But I'd like to look back and ask you, first of all, Richard, you know, what are the highlights, the lowlights? What are the things that you have really taken from this first few months of his presidency?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that what President Trump did on April 2nd was truly historic. And not just in the course of events around the world, but including in his own history. So in his first term, he put tariffs on particular products or particular countries. And those types of moves, although he was somewhat radical, are not at all out of line with what has been going on in the last decades or so. But what he did on April 2nd was truly historic. He put up tariffs on every single country, trade partner of the United States, and thereby violated every promise America had ever made on trade to anybody, anywhere. So in essence, it was an attack on the trade system. It wasn't a problem with steel or a problem with washing machines or even a problem with Chinese industrial subsidies overall or somebody's exchange rate. It was everybody all at once. It was basically Trump saying the system is rigged against America. America's a victim here, and America's lashing out with tariffs that are big, bold, and everywhere at once. Now, that is truly historic. It means essentially that the U.S. has stopped being the leader of the world trading system. Now, that is by far the biggest thing that he's done.
Richard, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that as a professor of economics, you focused on the economic side of this. We're getting into the tariffs straight away. You were in the Bush administration. You worked on trade policy during the U.S.'s spat with Japan. How different has Trump's approach been in this second term?
Well, it's completely different. I mean, if you want to compare it to Bush Senior, the administration I was in, it's completely different. The trade policy that came out of the United States, really up until just this year with Trump, was going through layers of interagency process where you'd have dozens of lawyers and economists and diplomats looking at what they would do. So anything that came out of even Trump One had been through an interagency process where they thought about the implications, they thought about whether it was legal or not, how to phrase it so it would be immune to legal challenge and all those sorts of things, and also the economic implications. And they would listen to domestic industry and buyers about concerns they might have. So they had some idea of what they were doing before they did it. Now, since January of this year, that trade policy seems to be done completely on the fly without any kind of background work whatsoever. So you often see trade policies coming out that seem almost angry or almost random. And then a day or even less after they come out, they're reversed. And as a consequence, it looks like these things are done in a bubble of wishful thinking, surrounded by advisors who are afraid to tell the president that every word is not the most genius play that the world has ever seen. But then when those genius plays get turned into policy and go out into the real world people react, and then he backs off. So it's a process that seems to be completely broken, and it's completely different, not just from all the previous presidents, but different than what he did in his first term when there was far more adults in the room, so to speak, and he was constrained in what he was doing.
Richard, you talk about this in your new book, The Great Trade Hack, How Trump's Trade War Fails and the World Moves On. I thought it was very interesting, but what you're saying there, you know, it sounds to me like the description of chaos. You're saying it's so different from your experience in the White House. And I think it's fair to say, at least from looking from an outside perspective, it's not just different from Bush Senior, it's different from many other presidents who've come before and since. But in your book, you talk about Trump's policy perhaps not being as chaotic as it seems. What do you mean by that?
Well, so I think if you think about trade policy coming out of Trump as policy with real goals, you know, to do something with the trade deficit, to promote industry, to hurt foreigners, whatever, it seems totally chaotic and erratic. It's hard to understand what he's doing because it makes no sense economically. It's economically incoherent. But I think if you actually read the words of what he says when he's not launching these things, and also if you read the words in the president's trade agenda for 2025, he's talking about these tariffs as vengeance or grievance, driven by a deep sense of victimhood that somehow Trump believes, and I think he believes this deeply, that the US has been ripped off by the rest of the world, by global elite who are abroad, who are ripping off America and therefore American workers, and a global elite traders inside America enabling this whole thing. So there's a sort of idea that the global elite got rich ripping off the American workers and set up the whole system to enable that steal. And that's exactly how they present this, and the trade policy is to overcome that. Now, that all makes sense because when he lashes out with a strong, very unusual, historically unprecedented tariff, for example, and he's saying, I'm getting back. America's standing up for itself. It's using America might to redress the system. Now, when it goes out there and he has to come back in this grievance doctrine, that's what I call it, like you're trying to assuage the grievance, he looks flexible. And then as long as he gets something from foreigners or can say he got something from foreigners, he can characterize this as strong moves and he's got something out of foreigners that nobody else did. But interestingly, this is coherent when you think of it as driven by grievance, not by some particular goal of the trade deficit or reindustrialization or helping American workers. It's not driven by goals. It's driven by grievance.
So you're talking about an economics of emotion rather than any kind of hard-headed book learning version of economic theory.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way I understand it. There's different people have different theories, but people who insist on thinking about this as trade policy are continuously shaking their head and going, why did he do that? That's crazy. But when you think about it as striking out, it makes perfect sense. So a very good example of this, is he following goals or is he following grievances, is what he did in early June when he, without notice, apparently without any study, moved the steel tariffs from 25% up to 50%, which is an enormous increase. And that means that every American manufacturer who uses steel or aluminum will be paying 50% more for their inputs than their competitors all around the world. Now, that clearly is not a way you would do if you wanted to reindustrialize America as a whole, although it may protect a few more American steel jobs. Now, whether he actually stays with that or not, there's a very long tradition of him making bold moves and then backing off, as the financial markets now call it, the taco trade. Trump always chickens out. So he does something that seems to be outrageous, even very bad for the United States, but he sounds good and it makes him look forceful. It looks like America's standing up, but then he backs off and he looks wise in doing so. So, it will be interesting to see if it follows the same pattern.
So, Richard, you've mentioned that steel example. There are, as you say, several examples of this kind of striking out, backing off approach of Donald Trump. when you're talking to businesses, when you're talking to students of business, what do you say to them about America today, and what have we learned? What can we learn from the last few months to take forward with us into the next few?
Well, I think the key is that America has become a protectionist country. They're no longer interested in leading the system. So it's no use waiting to the world trading system going back to the way it used to be, where the U.S. actually cared about the system and supported it. That's not the U.S. anymore. U.S. has decided to break all the rules, use unilateral power to exploit, to extract concessions from foreigners, and in a way that completely disrespects the rules. So if you are looking for the U.S. it's to go back, you're making a mistake. So from now on, the rest of the world has to try and keep the system together, and they can simply do that by trying to follow the rules. But for business, in terms of Trump, if you want to predict what he's going to do, look through grievance, not economic goals. That he's pursuing things that sound good, that make him sound look strong. And what he really wants is happy headlines, and then he's willing to back off. So the good news of that is he really does not want to destroy the world trading system. And when the things he does actually cause a lot of damage, either in the United States or in the rest of the world, he backs off. And my bet is that he's going to back off on a lot of this stuff. So it's very nerve-wracking and it's very volatile. But I think one thing we have seen is that he's always backing off so that it doesn't get too bad.
A fairly common reading of recent economic history is that the U.S. was foundational in the building of the kind of globalized economic system and has benefited from it massively. Some have posited that the age we're in now is the US turning away from globalization. Do you think that's a fair characterization? It seems to me from what you're saying that there's this kind of strange middle way being trodden where Donald Trump keeps walking towards that precipice and then coming back. Do you see a world in which the US is outside of a globalized trading system, or just an actor that is strongly critical of it?
What the Trump administration is doing right now is pretending there is no system. So they are acting outside the system. And it looks like so far that the rest of the world, who accounts for 85% of world trade, US only accounts for about 15% of world trade, that they will continue to act like they did before with some modification. So I think what we're going to is the US reverting to a much older tradition in the US, which is isolationism, where they put up tariffs, countries retaliated against their tariffs, and so the US just imports less and exports less and goes on their way, and countries deal with them using WTO rules or not, but it's not that rule breaking doesn't spread. So it's an interesting thing about Trump is he's not come up with a new system. He's not trying to reform the system. He has not proposed an alternative system. What he's just done is pretend that the one that we have doesn't exist. He breaks whatever rules he wants whenever, and he views that as a sign of American strength and striking back. It also fits into this grievance doctrine because in his reading of history, the rule-based trading system was set up by American traders, global elitists, in the process of getting rich while ripping off American workers. That's the narrative. So breaking rules isn't like an unintended side consequence. It's the goal. The idea that these rules need to be destroyed or at least dissipated by the US is what he's after. But interestingly, he has not proposed some other system which isn't rigged against the United States. He's just going to the law of the jungle and relying on the market power of the United States to try and extract benefits from other countries. So that's where I think we're going to. We're having a country like the US will just become more closed off from trade, but still engage in trade. But the rest of the world sort of moves on without them.
And what does that mean for multinationals? What does that mean for business leaders?
Well, certainly, at least in the United States, the idea that you need to make, in the North America at least, to sell in North America is even stronger than it was before. And many companies had already started doing that, car companies in particular. And so that trend will continue. Now, the whole rest of the world is less clear. I mean, there was, even before Donald Trump's re-election, the shocks of COVID, for example, alerted many multinational corporations that the world is not as safe as it used to be, that this thing can go wrong for months at a time, all across many sectors. And so companies have started going to localizing their supply chains in order to make them more resilient to shocks. And what Trump has been essentially doing is he pushed that in a big direction. I think it's going that way. But it's still, what Trump has done is mostly applicable to the United States. And there I think we'll see people really changing their strategical approach to the US market. And in the rest of the world, continue with this trend of regionalizing production.
Might we see a new global leader, China, another great power, the EU bloc?
So I think what, you know, just to kick that off, in the book, I argue that we've seen the beginning of the post-American leadership era, and that started on April 3rd when he announced all these tariffs, or April 2nd when he announced all the tariffs. And that means there is no leader. I mean, the U.S. hasn't been an effective leader for a couple decades, but still, now there's no leader and it's not coming back. So the question you ask, and it's a good one, is who takes over? And I think the answer is no one. So the European Union is by far the leading contender because it's very respectful of multilateralism just by its very nature. It has to be law-abiding, rule-following. But many countries have a beef with the EU, and also the EU is not willing to be the enlightened self-interest leader that the United States was. The United States did open its markets to lots of people, and that gave it a lot of credibility and soft power with people. The EU is much less interested in that sort of thing. Also, problems with, like, for instance, the CBAM tariffs and whatever. So I don't think EU can take the lead there. In any case, the EU is not one thing. China, definitely not. China is the other second largest importer, largest exporter in the world. But so many people have a problem with China manufacturing exports of one type or another. You know, their manufacturing grew so fast. Now they're the sole world superpower in manufacturing. That happened so fast that it really caused a lot of problems with a lot of countries. And I don't think people view China as the leader in the same way that the US was. And the same with Japan. Its market's really not large enough and it's not generous enough with its market access to kind of get that leadership position. But instead, I think we'll go to what I call in the book leadership herds. Now, there are a couple examples of these that we've already seen. So the first was when the Trump administration, the first administration, tried to kill the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which had been negotiated with the US, but this, you know, Obama second administration, they got to the conclusion, but Obama didn't actually get it passed through Congress. So when Trump came into office, first thing he did was withdraw the US from TPP. And many people expected the TPP to collapse at that time. So it was a classic example of no leader, the thing collapses. But Japan put together a loose coalition of countries to reinvigorate this Trans-Pacific partner into a new thing called the Comprehensive Partnership, and CPTPP, and it went ahead without the United States. So there we had a form of leadership which didn't involve another hegemon taking over from the US, but somebody kind of leading a coalition. We had another example of that when the US under Trump's administration killed the appellate body court of the WTO by blocking the appointment of judges so that they didn't have enough judges to hold any cases. So the court died. Then the European Union organized a whole bunch of countries, including China, and to set up a new interim court called the Multi-Party Interim Agreement on Dispute Settlements. And that now has replaced the organization that the US killed. So in both of these cases, it was coalition of people who had similar interests without names, without committee structures. There's no chairman, there's no G this or G that, but they collaborate together in order to keep the system going ahead. And I think that's what we're going to go to, kind of collective leadership or leadership herds, as I call it.
And does that world benefit the business community? Do you see sunlit uplands for them? I mean, what I'm wondering really is, you know, can people running multinationals breathe a sort of sigh of relief that this first 6 months is over? I wonder, and I'm sure many wonder, if Trump can possibly keep up this level of disruption going forward. I mean, from January onwards, it's been an avalanche of news month to month. It has, though, slowed down as we've approached the summer.
Absolutely. So let me answer that in two goes. So the leadership herds could potentially allow the WTO system to move on and start to address some of the 21st century challenges, such as how do we deal with climate change in the trade system, or how do we deal with cyber issues and cyber attacks in the world trading system. The U.S. has not been leading these things, so the rules have not been updated for 10 to 15 years. So now with the U.S. standing out of the way, it's possible that groups of countries who have an interest in dealing with, for instance, carbon taxes, they can make rules and move ahead. So it's possible that there is a silver lining for the world trading system as a whole. Now, another point which you raised was about the pace of disruption, so to speak. And it's been absolutely fast and furious. But really, what it was there was a bunch of normal things. It was like, you know, I call it the Trump tariff show season one was 2016 to 2020. And this was the Trump tariff show season two. And before April 2nd, it was the same sort of fun and games. April 2nd changed everything. And that so much that it led to meltdown in markets, a bear market, et cetera. We saw the turmoil, and that's why Trump had to back off on the 9th of April to prevent the global financial crisis from melting down. He suspended those tariffs for 90 days, and he said it was in order to get deals with foreigners in order to allow them to redress the evils that America has been suffering with during that time. And so that's why we're in a kind of a lull, because they're supposed to be talking with these foreign countries to be making deals. But it's just the grievance has to keep being paid. So he keeps coming up with things like 50% on the Europeans unless they make a deal in 3 days. And then that also gets pushed off, or 50% more tariffs on steel. We'll see if that gets pushed off. The whole idea that is calming down is about this July 8th deadline. That's when the 90 days expires. And in principle, if you haven't had a deal with the United States, your tariffs snap back to the April 2nd level. Now we'll see if that actually happens, because of course the April 2nd tariffs led to chaos in the markets, which could then just restart. So that's the first thing. It could all restart in early July. The second thing is, in the budget bill, there is a section called 899, which would allow Trump to do with taxes on foreign investors inside the United States what he's been doing with tariffs. So the president could unilaterally say, you know, you Luxembourg are cheating Americans on this tax, and so we're going to tax everything that Luxembourg has in the U.S. as a result of that. And would be unilateral power, where he has a whole new arsenal of things to create chaos and to vent his grievance, to strike out, to rebalance this victimhood sort of stuff. So it's possible that he's just refreshing his arsenal with tax tools rather than tariff tools. So it's not at all sure that this thing is over.
Fascinating, Richard. So, I mean, passing your overview, I would say that business leaders should feel at least slightly more hopeful for the next few months than for the last few months. Hopefully, after some of these deadlines pass, we'll have a clearer view. Although I would say that, you know, that has been said before about several of Trump's pronouncements. I want to just briefly finish by talking about whether or not there's anything leaders, business leaders can do anything to avoid the worst outcomes. I mean, we've seen reactions from large companies with their ordering, with their deal making, or their lack of deal making. What would your view on this be? Is it a wait and see kind of moment, or are there decisive actions they should be taking now?
Well, at least until, you know, this July deadline, wait and see is a very good idea. But what business leaders can do is push for liberalization with third countries. And that's already going on big time. So the UK and India signed a free trade agreement since the April 2nd tariffs. And the UK actually acceded to the CPTPP since then. And China and Brazil have signed a trade deal since then. So business leaders can push their governments to open up other markets to help replace the American market which was being shut. And that would be good for the system. The second thing is to encourage their governments to follow the rules. So all we need is that the 85% of the world trade, but done by countries outside the United States, continue to follow the rules, then the rules-based system will survive, which has been very good for business for decades. And so by asking their governments to follow the rules, they can protect the rules. And that's one thing they can do. And also the other is to push for this liberalization, opening up the whole rest of the world, not waiting for America.
Thank you, Richard. Richard, I think it would be great to speak again after some of these deadlines have been hit in July and look a little bit more at the next few months to come up. You mentioned your book, The Four Scenarios for a Post-US Leadership Trade Order. I know we've already touched on some of that. I'd like to get into it in even more detail and to hear more from you about what to expect, because we talk about the next couple of quarters, but in fact, we should really be talking about the next 3.5 years and whether or not these things will calm down, I suppose, is anybody's guess, but I feel much better informed having spoken to you about it today. Richard Baldwin is the Professor of International Economics at IMD, an expert in global economic policy and theory. Thank you, Richard, for coming on the show.
My pleasure for being here. Thank you for having me.
To learn more about Richard's work, you can find his profile on imd.org. If you want to read his book, The Great Trade Hack, How Trump's Trade War Fails and the World Moves On, you can find that online at the Center for Economic Policy Research, CEPR.org, or you can order a physical copy from Amazon. We'll see you next time.